Test Talks, Episode 6. Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test automation. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com, and today we're going to be talking about the 6 best practices for test automation. Let's not even call them best practices, because in the real world, every company is different. So I'm going to call them the top 6 good practices that you should follow or think about when you're doing test automation or creating a test automation framework. So today it's just going to be me and you again. There's no interview set up. So let's get right into it. So here are my top 6 automation good practices. Number 6, start with the easy things first. Number 5, don't run against all OSs and browsers. Number 4, make a distinction between errors versus failures. Number 3, don't treat your test scripts as code, right? You want to create layers. We'll get into that. 2, not everything should be a UI test. And number 1, synchronization. All right, from the top. Number 6, start with the easy things first. This may seem obvious, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes I've seen groups start test automation and they tackle the most insanely hardest thing possible to automate. And that's fine. You know, if you have developers that are really up for the challenge, but you know, normally what you want to do is you want to start with the easy things first. It's usually people just starting to learn automation, or they're starting to learn the application itself. So you really want to take baby steps. And you know, another big reason for starting easy is if you go after the low hanging fruit first, you can usually create something fairly quickly that can be refactored fairly quickly. And that, you know, your manager can see right away the benefits of automation. So if you're starting in a company that doesn't have any automation, and a lot of times, you know, what I would do is I would target, you know, some of the smoke tests. You know, usually a smoke test or a small set of tests, they're usually very basic. And so those are the types of tests I would start with. Along these same lines, when you're testing something, not everything needs to be automated, or not everything needs to be automated 100%. So, you know, a lot of times people are so focused on, I need to automate this 100%, you know, without really understanding the needs of the actual business user. But remember, the whole point is quality, and you do have a customer, whether it's, you know, your manager or other users within the company, or business users that really need these tests to run in order to do something later on. You know, for example, sometimes not everything needs to be automated 100%. But I used to work for an insurance company. You know, I was talking to some business users and I've noticed they were manually entering in these long, long policies by hand in order to get to a certain point where they can do certain rating. So they would enter a bunch of coverages, like enter a bunch of cars, a bunch of farms, a bunch of houses, and they would do this so they can just get to a point where they could change a state and click on a rate button so they could double check what those different rates are to make sure that the premiums that are coming up were correct. What I noticed right away is, you know, this was very easy to automate. So I created a script, and I made it so you can data drive the script. And so you could go in, run this one script, and you could tell it to, you know, create a policy that has 20 cars, 50 houses, you know, whatever they wanted, they could data drive it. The difficult part was actually verifying the rating. So there's all these formulas going on. And so they just felt more comfortable doing that piece manually. And that's cool. So what I've done is I just introduced automation to get them to the point where it saved them a ton of time. And it didn't automate it all the way, but it automated it just enough to get it into the state where they could use it and really get some big value out of it. And it was a really easy thing to automate. So that's a tip. Just because you can't, or it doesn't make sense to automate a full business process, now, if there's even one piece that can be automated and it will save someone repetitive manual work, I say automate it and they're going to love you for it. So that's number 6. Start with the easy things first. I know I went a little off topic, but there you go. My number 5 good practice is, you know, once you have your test scripts created, you know, I don't recommend, and once again, this depends on what your company is, but I mean, I have a hard time imagining when this would ever be true, but I'm sure there are cases where it is true, is you don't run all your tests against every single browser version and every single OS version. So I know managers sometimes think, oh, we have these automation scripts. Let's run them against every conceivable version of IE, Firefox, Chrome, and every OS version that ever existed. You know, don't give in to them. Don't do it. Always ask why. Why do you want to do that? I understand there's going to be different users using different browsers, but really, you know, unless you're doing like a browser compatibility test, you want to run the test. But I have a hard time imagining that you'd have to run your whole full test suite against every single browser and every single OS version. So the reason why I say this is once you start running your test in, a continuous integration environment, they're going to take some time. And so you really want to get feedback as quickly as possible when you're running your test automation so that when a developer checks in their code, some tests are run, and they get some feedback, some immediate feedback on whether or not what they checked in broke the build. So that's mainly what you use these test automation scripts for. And so, you know, if you start running these scripts against every single OS, every single browser, you're making the test run longer, one thing. And another thing is you start getting into issues where you start just debugging certain scripts against like IE just because they don't run against IE, but it's not an application issue. It's just a Selenium browser. IE is very funky. IE is usually very hard to automate. I would question what is the value of running every single test against, you know, every single browser, especially IE. I recently read an interesting blog post by Alistair Scott from watermelon.com. And basically his blog post was, you know, do you really need to run your web driver tests in IE? So this is a little bit different, but you know, I'm just going to go off here on this because I think it's really important. And he recommends that to avoid running WebDriver tests against IE always. And he gives some reasons why. Basically, the older versions of Internet Explorer, they're really not very testable. You know, Microsoft didn't use the same type of specifications that Firefox and Chrome have. And so, you know, it's really very hard to test. And so you usually have to mess around with IE with the different security zones and proxies and autocomplete and all these different configurations on the machine. You know, you could specify that programmatically within Firefox or Chrome. So that's one reason why he recommends not running the browser against Internet Explorer. So the second reason why he recommends it is that the IE driver itself is not as mature as the Chrome and Firefox drivers. And so he goes so far as saying, you know, if you have to run against IE, you're better off not having any automated UI test at all. So, you know, I don't know if I go that far. I think you do need a test against IE. And I know IE 11, supposedly Microsoft is really going to focus on implementing WebDriver for IE 11 and really following the standards. So hopefully from IE 11 on, we won't have this issue. But for now, so I don't fully agree that you shouldn't run against IE at all. But I'm saying, you know, in general, for anything, you know, you should maybe have a small set of core tests that you run against all browsers. You know, very small set, not the whole test suite. And then your full test suite, you just run against one browser all the time. And so you can mix that up. And if you have them running against the CI environment, you can run against, say, Chrome most times and then mix it up and run against Firefox. But, you know, in general, if you're running against Firefox and Chrome and you're running your core tests against all of them, I think that gives you a pretty good sense of the quality of your application under test. So if it's not really a browser compatibility test, then, you know, the vendors for these browsers do their own testing. So let's assume that the functionality for the browser itself is going to work. So that's my recommendation. Take it for what you want. But I would just create a small core set of tests and run them just against all the browsers, against a few of the different OSs. You know, I would run my whole test suite, though, just against a limited set of configurations. And so it's going to save you time for debugging and you know, scripting around issues that really aren't adding value. So you always ask the question, is this adding value? Is this adding quality? If it's not really adding quality or adding value, then I'd say drop it. It's more of an education type thing. Managers sometimes get in the head, we have all these tests, let's run them against everything all the time. I think it's part of our job as automation engineers to kind of steer them, direct them, and educate them on the exact process that we should follow. So that's number five. Don't run
against all browsers and OS versions.
Okay, so for number four, test errors versus failures. So I think it's really important that you start making a distinction really early on when you're doing test automation of distinguishing between what's an actual error versus what's a failure. And the reason for this, it's going to save you a lot of headaches when, once again, when you're running all these tests
and some of them start failing. And so your developers start seeing this, and so they really need to know, is this failing because it's a real issue, or is it failing just because, you know, you have some flaky test that decided not to work that time, but if you reran it, it would work fine. So it's not finding an actual bug. It's an issue with your environment or with your script itself that you need to fix. And so this is something I've known about and thought about, but I really didn't have a good way to articulate it until I took John Sommez's course on Selenium from Pluralsight, where he actually has some best practices that he talks about. And one of them is, you know, to definitely make a distinction between test errors versus failures. And I thought it was so important that I know I incorporated it into the best practices within my test automation framework at work. And I think it's really going to make a big difference once we start ramping up our test in the CI environment, just to make sure that things are running correctly, that we're going to make an effort to distinguish between what's an error and what's a failure. So a failure is that something is actually broken, that the test failed because the actual condition being tested was not met. So say you had an assertion saying that the value should equal 5, but it comes back 4, right? That's a real failure because you expect 5, you get 4. That's a failure. That's something that should be addressed right away because there's an actual issue with your business logic. You know, assertion failures, those are actual failures. Those are the ones you want to highlight, and those are the ones you want to get addressed right away by your dev team. Now, errors, on the other hand, are not caused by the application under test. It's usually caused by something else, not actual functionality of your application that you're testing. The main reason why you want to make this distinction is that, you know, it's going to give you confidence that the test failing are only failing when there's an actual failure, meaning you've done an assertion, the assertion is not passing, there's an actual issue with the code that the developer checked in. You want to have trust in your test suite. You want to make sure that when it goes red, that it's really red and that people need to pay attention. But if you stop mixing in errors and failures, and so people just start getting used to seeing the automation test fail and think, oh, well, I don't know, is it a real failure? Is it not? So right off the bat, make distinctions between what's an actual error versus a failure. I think that's an important distinction that everyone should make. So that's number 4. So number 3 is don't treat your test scripts as code. What I mean by this is, you know, we should not be writing our tests as if it's actual code. And the reason why is you want to be able to have anyone be look at your test and understand what's going on. So they don't need to be a developer. They don't need to be a Selenium expert. You know, your manager could look at it. A business expert can look at your test and know what's going on. If you don't design your test at the right layer, you're going to get into a lot of different issues. And so what you really want to do is you want to make a distinction between your test and the automation framework. So usually you use a good thing is to use an approach like use layers, that you have the first layer are your test. And those tests then call, say, your automation framework that handles the actual code of how to implement that particular method or class that's being called by your test. And that method or class uses page object. So all the technical detail is hidden within that page object. So if something changes, say someone changes the name of a field, you're just going to that one place within your page object to make the change to the field. You're not touching any of your tests. And so this is really important. If a field really did change and you had that field hard-coded all over your test and you had thousands of tests, you would have to change thousands of tests. And that's going to waste everyone's time. You're going to miss things, and it's not going to be very maintainable. So you really want to make your tests maintainable. And one way to do it is to really separate things into layers so that, you know, your tests are tests. They read like tests. They read like almost like English. The more technical information is pushed down the stack into, say, either, you know, a class or a page object. This applies to everything, even with QuickTest Professional. So in an older project, I used QuickTest Professional and I created an automation framework. And what I did is I created a function library. And so the function library is where all the code lived for the testing of the application. But when someone wrote a test, all they were doing was invoking my actions. So they'd have a button click or a patient insert. So they had these like English type function names that they would call and pass parameters, but all the logic was handled within a function library. And so what happened is our application at first only supported a web browser. So what they end up doing though is they also created a .NET application of the same exact functionality. For example, if you were to spy on it within QuickTest Professional on the web piece, it would have a web browser, browser.page.frame, and then Swift window object, right? So when you spied on it, though, with QTP within the .NET version, it only started at the Swift object level. So it ignored all that browser thing. So if I had hard-coded all this information into all the tests, and management came to me and said, okay, we want to run those tests now against the .NET application also. Can you do that? I'd have to say no. Because we designed it correctly up front, you know, we look like geniuses. Yeah, well, sure, we can run it against the browser and against the .NET version and not have to change any of our tests. All I had to do was go into the framework, go into that function library, and just at the very beginning, have some logic that says, are you a browser or are you a .NET application? And based on that, it would know what path to use to identify the fields within the application. And so once I made that change in the function library, just point out tests against the thick client application, and they ran beautifully. Didn't have to make a change to any of the scripts themselves, just had to go to that one location. This is the same thing. This is, you know, one example of why you don't want to create your tests as if they're code. And so, you know, another aspect of this is you want your test code, you know, should be written in a special way that will make it, you know, easy to understand and simplify the way of using, you know, a programming language. So someone doesn't need to be a Java developer. They don't need to know Selenium. They don't need to know how to pass a driver or a driver instance or instantiate a variable. You know, you should be able to write your automation in such a way that, you know, it's very simple to write and that all the technical details handled in the automation framework. You've separated out all that logic to be handled in the automation framework so that you have a few core people, you know, that are maybe hardcore developers, handle the automation piece of it. But that the actual creation of tests, you know, you don't need all your developers doing it. You can have people that aren't so tech savvy also create tests using your framework. So anyone should be able to look at the code and say, you know, I totally understand what's going on. I definitely follow this. This makes sense to me. And so once again, thanks to John Samez. This is another thing he talked about within his Pluralsight course on creating automation frameworks. He has a bunch of rules that he uses for what you should never do when you're creating automation frameworks to make your tests more readable. And so one of them is, you know, don't require step definitions to declare variables. So don't require someone to have to declare a variable. You know, never require the use of a new keyword. Now, some of these would be actual best practices if you were creating actual code for a client, code that you're actually delivering to a client. But this is code that you're using to create automation, that you're using to create tests. So the rules would be slightly different because you're not thinking as a developer creating code you're going to deliver to a customer. So our goal really is to make these tests as easy to write as possible. So if you have to make a choice between a best practice for code or ease of use, always side on ease of use. And some other nevers are, so never expose the browser or DOM, never require to pass a Selenium driver back and forth between the tests. You should be able to handle that within the framework itself. And your test should read like English that almost anyone could read. So I think if you develop that right off the bat, that, you know, in the long run, tests will be easier to maintain. They'll be less brittle. And just going forward, it would make everyone's lives a lot easier, and especially your own if you're the one responsible for automation. So definitely check that out. Don't treat your scripts as code. Number two, not everything should be a UI test. So along the same lines of making your life easier as an automation engineer, if you're working on a project with many teams that are going to automate their scripts and you need to create a framework that have them use, you know, make sure that not all your tests are UI tests. Not everything needs to be a UI test. And so, you know, a lot of people, you know, really give QTP a bad name. They go, oh, it's slow, it doesn't work, and they think another tool is going to solve all their problems. Well, if you're using Selenium for UI testing, it's going to be just the same exact problems that you have with a tool like QuickTest Professional. It's the same thing. UI testing is difficult. It's hard to make reliable. So you really want to try to not focus all your efforts on a UI test. I'm not saying don't do any UI tests. I'm saying that a majority of your tests, you know, your developers should be doing unit tests. That, you know, really if they're not doing unit testing, I would say, you know, let's start there. That's where you're going to get the biggest bang for your buck. Making sure your developers are doing unit tests, and then when they check in their code, they're getting these instant feedback. And so the reason why they're getting instant feedback is unit tests are very small. They're very specific. They run very quickly, within milliseconds, that you can get information on whether or not something worked or was broken. I think most people probably have seen this before, but it's called the test pyramid. So visualize in your mind a pyramid, right? And at the base, you have unit tests. So that's the majority. That's holding everything up. So in the middle are your API integration tests. So this is really where, you know, I would focus most of my efforts within a framework. So if you had REST services or web services that you can interact with and get information with from the application, I would try to automate more of these types of tests, more of the API tests, more of the tests under the covers that don't necessarily focus on the UI tests. And so these tests, once again, because they're not invoking the UI, they're going to be quicker. They're going to be easier to maintain. You're going to have less weird issues with synchronization issues usually. So, you know, you want to do more API tests, more, you know, integration type tests. And then on the tippity top of that, you know, this very small piece of the pyramid, if you're still envisioning this magical automation pyramid, is where the UI tests would live. So you want to have almost 100% unit tests. And then most of your other automation tests would be API tests, but then you do have UI tests. And so the UI tests really would be end-to-end testing, but you don't need everything as a UI test. If, for example, say you're testing a calculation on a web page, and all that page is doing, it's going out to a server, and the business logic actually lives within that server. So the calculation is being done on that server, and it's just spitting back the information. You know, you don't need a UI test to test all the different types of boundary tests you can do. So this helps with coverage also. So maybe you have one UI test that tests end-to-end, right? But, you know, you do all these other boundary type testing at an API type level where you're interacting with that business logic that lives on that server so that, you know, the server doesn't care if you're a UI or not. It's not something that you need a UI for, is what I'm saying. So it's not dependent on the UI. That logic can be tested independently of the UI. So those are the types of tests you really want to focus your automation efforts on. And then, you know, manual testing will not go away. You're always going to need to do manual testing. So ideally, automation basically frees up your QA testers to really do more exploratory type testing. And this is the type of testing that probably, to be honest, is what's going to find a majority of your real bugs. Because, you know, if you have something automated and scripted, it's really more for like peace of mind to know things that you know about are working. But, you know, if you're doing exploratory type testing, you have these business users that are going to use it the way it's going to. They're really going to focus on the areas that they know may be more buggy than others. So you always want to include manual testing within your efforts. And so, you know, this also goes along the lines of if you're running smaller tests, quicker tests, it's going to help when you're doing, if you have to run these tests in a CI, continuous integration environment. So your developers will get feedback quicker. And it's just going to make things a lot easier in the long run. So that's number two. Not everything should be a UI test. And now, number one, synchronization. And this is huge. If you want to be successful with test automation, you need to get your synchronization effort worked out. The biggest thing I've seen with synchronization is either people don't have enough synchronization or wait points within the script, or when they do, it's like a thread dot sleep. And so here's another rant. Don't use thread.sleep. Thread.sleep should not be used unless you literally need to wait X amount of time before you do another action. So with thread.sleep, really, I think, causes more harm than good. And I can understand the reason why people may use thread.sleep. It's easy. A lot of times you may use it and you may go, oh, I'll refactor this later. But, you know, those are the types of things that, as you start building up your test, you get into the hundreds and the thousands of tests, these thread.sleeps start adding up. So a thread.sleep is a hard wait. So if you tell thread.sleep.5 seconds, it'll wait 5 seconds. So you send a request, you get a response back, and that, say that response happens or the UI refreshes within 1 second. Well, because you have a hard-coded wait of 5 seconds, it waits the full 5 seconds. Yeah, you're like, big deal, yeah. These, when they start being sprinkled all over the place, it'll drive you crazy. You'll start asking, why are these tests taking so long? And then you start looking at it and you're like, what are all these thread.sleeps doing in here? This is outrageous. So first thing, save yourself time. Don't use thread.sleep unless you have a really, really, really good reason to. One of the biggest killers of test automation script reliability and performance is the failure to use proper synchronization and wait points in any test automation tool you may use for UI testing. But specifically with Selenium, you know, there are two main types of synchronizations that you can use. One is explicit wait, I think is the preferred method. And the second one is implicit wait. So explicit and implicit. So by adding synchronization points in your scripts, it helps facilitate when your tests need to wait for a response from an application. So this is important because when you're testing a web application, say, you send a request to a server, server response time may vary. So based on that, your UI may not refresh at the same point all the time. And one, you know, sometimes it may get data back within 5 seconds, it may get it back within 2 seconds. But if you have nothing waiting for that to verify that you've received what you expected to receive before you continue, you're going to start getting really flaky tests. So just because your test passed a few times does not mean that your test scripts are working. So I've seen instances where, you know, a test runs fine a few times, then you put it in the CI environment, and for some reason there's something slower in the CI environment, and scripts start failing left and right. And so these types of issues usually are due to not using synchronization and not using the right synchronization. So you always want to make an effort to add synchronization points to the places in your scripts that you know could be an issue. So as I said, don't use thread.sleep. You want to use an explicit wait. So using this method, you can tell Selenium to wait only till a certain condition is met. So once that condition is met, the test will proceed to the next step. So if you have an explicit, you tell the web driver to wait up till 30 seconds for something to happen. So say it waits 30 seconds for a button to appear on a screen, or you select a drop down from one area and it refreshes something in another area of your application. So if you get a response back within 3 seconds and your explicit wait is set to 30 seconds, your script will continue. So it's up to 30 seconds. It's not a hard wait of 30 seconds. So you're telling it wait up to X amount of time. But if it happens sooner, then continue after that. So this is a big time saver. So all those little thread.sleeps that you may have with 5 seconds, 5 seconds, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, if things are happening 1 and 2 seconds, it actually waits up to that full amount that you have hard-coded. But with an explicit wait, it'll continue. So if you had 30 seconds, if it happens within 2 seconds, it'll continue and it won't wait the full 30 seconds. So this is why this is the preferred way of using synchronization. So, you know, types of things you usually wait for is whether or not an element is present or not present, visible, not visible, clickable, you know, whatever. Now, the second type of wait you can do in Selenium is called an implicit wait. The way implicit waits are different is basically an implicit wait tells the web driver to pull the DOM basically for a certain amount of time when trying to find an element that's not immediately available. And so by default, the setting is usually 0, but you can set the implicit wait to set for the life of the web driver, to set for the life of the web driver object instance. So you could tell it, you know, you could hard code 10 seconds in there. But this is really bad. This is like a blunt tool. And basically, this implicit wait would apply to every time the web driver looks up an element. This can really slow things down because you have it hard coded once again. It's not as refined as the explicit wait approach, so I would always use explicit wait. Now, in summary, don't use thread.sleep. Use explicit waits instead. Focus on your synchronizations in all your tests, and make sure you have that really handled really well before you promote it to your CI environment. So one thing I would do is at least be able to run your tests 3, 4, 5 times in a row successfully before you promote it into CI. I think that's a pretty good rule. You know, you want to run it more than once, and you know, you want to make sure that you have the correct synchronizations in the correct locations to really help with your test being more reliable and less flaky. So that's it for my top 6 best practices for test automation. So once again, number 6, start with the easy things first. Number 5, don't run against every single browser, every single OS version. Number 4, test errors versus failures. Number 3, don't treat your test scripts like code. Number 2, not everything should be a UI test. And number 1, synchronization. So if you focus on those 6 things, I think you're well on your way to having a successful automation project. Thank you for joining me on Test Talks. And remember, you can find the links to everything of value that we talked about today in the show notes at www.testtalks/06. And as always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.